Left, right, left. Right, left, right. Now, really get fixed each time that you bring your head back. Left, right, left. Right, left, right. Left, right, left. Right, left, right. Now we'll do it with a little jump. So it's like this. And. Right, left. And. Right, left, right. And.
This aging face upon a youthful body belongs to Vito, perhaps the oldest, most lucid hippie. A brilliant sculptor, he runs a Los Angeles troupe which gives freak-out dance performances at happenings. His wife, Sue, aged 25, awaits their second child. Like all hippies, they attack the middle-aged values of their land of milk and money, its worship of property, unquestioning acceptance of the quick buck, and the ultimate achievement of the three-car garage. Conventionally unconventional, hippies repudiate most of society's uplifting moralities. The family, patriotism, chastity, the sanctity of marriage, respect for the law. They deny the right and competence of parents, schools, and governments to make decisions for everyone. A far-out arch-hippie, but the only one I met who's also against LSD.
I think of it as a... I think of it as an escape from the good things that are happening around us and the bad things that are happening around us. So most of us need to get away from the bad things that are happening around us. I haven't any one of the kids, for example, a teenager, will come to me and say, "Hey, Vito, you're going to be bugged." I said, "Bugged about what?" She says, "I got loaded on some LSD last night. I got wasted on some LSD last night." They say so themselves. Listen to them. They'll tell you what's happening behind that stuff. They use words like wasted, you know, and I'm, you know, I fell out behind some LSD. So I think that getting loaded behind any kind of junk like that is to evade your responsibilities as a human being. Listen, if you're loaded behind LSD or some of those other hard, what I consider hard junk, you don't want to do anything except just sit back and contemplate, you know, something else. I have paintings around here by a guy who is a very dear friend of mine. And he's a groovy artist when he's straight. And he'll tell you, if you ask him, say, "Hey man, how about you're getting loaded behind, you know, LSD?" And he'll say, "Oh yeah, man, I really found it. Really, I found those new kind of things." And it isn't true, because when he is loaded behind that stuff, he doesn't do anything. He just stands there looking into space, man. You know, you could push him and he might fall down, but he isn't doing anything. People who are loaded behind that kind of thing don't do anything. This heavy kind of insistence every place you go with all the media about, you know, "Wow, look at the colors, look at the lights, look at the strobe things blinking. Man, you can really find a trip if you get loaded behind this stuff." There is a lot of that kind of thing insisting that we become aware of it, that we become sensitive to it. And a lot of the young people are sensitive to it, and they become curious about it. So they say, "Which of it is bad?" I say, "Man, all of it is bad. But if you have to have it, if you need to relax, I'm not going to put grass down. Marijuana isn't that bad." Say, "Well, a girl stopped me not too long ago, and she had a bumper sticker and it says, 'Let's legalize marijuana.' She says, 'Hey, you want this, Vito? Will you put that in your car?'" I'm not interested in propagandizing legalizing marijuana. The world is falling down around us. People are goofing around with that atom bomb button, and she's asking me, "Am I interested in legalizing marijuana?" I'm not interested. It doesn't motivate me that way. I'm interested in so many other things. I'm interested in the jeopardy and the threat of this establishment, where they're taking young people and slapping them into concentration camps that they call army camps, and those that they don't slap into a concentration camp like that, they're sending off into Vietnam to be killed or kill somebody else, and the ones that are left walking on the street are being terrorized by the police. This is the culture, you know. And the kid says, "No, baby, are you out of your mind? Forget about it. I'm going to find something that's going to make me nice and rosy and zonk me out, and I'm going to sit down on a floor someplace where it's not too cold, and I'm just going to get wiped out and stay wiped out, baby, and nothing's going to get through to me."
Your husband, of course, is very considerably older than you, isn't he? He's, what, 30
years?
He's
30 years older than me.
Now, how does he cross this generation gap? You see, this is a young people's revolution.
His philosophy has always been that we learn from people younger than ourselves, and an older person deserves respect who learns from a younger person and who listens to them. So I have learned from my child, and I'm able to help other people through what I've learned from. I've learned how to relax, how to relax, for immediate energy from our muscles, and relaxation, to get the carbon dioxide out for more relaxation, big breaths. And
you and your husband, of course, you don't take LSD, do you? You wouldn't...
Oh, no, we never have tried it. Don't want to fool around too much with chemicals and eliminate all the wrongs from our life, like sugar.
But don't you find that most of the hippies are on LSD?
Oh, so many of my friends have just ruined themselves. And I tell them, it's a military plot. It was happening in China in the revolution. And please, please, listen to me and stop it and get involved with something where you don't have to sit in a corner.
Don't the hippies who take LSD in pot, don't they think you're pretty square?
No, indeed. Because the minute they look at me, I convince them that I'm for real and I'm happy and they would love to be this way.
That was Vito and Sue Palakis from a 1960s BBC interview from the show Wicker's World. And this is Gnostic Media Research and Publishing's podcast, episode number 182. I'm your host, Jan Ervin. This is our last episode for year 5 of the Gnostic Media Podcast. Actually, the 5-year anniversary was October 23rd. This episode is an interview with Sue Palakis titled Vito and His Freaks, and is being released on Monday, October 28, 2013. This interview with Sue was recorded on Saturday, September 14, 2013. In our continuing investigation into MKUltra, today I interview Sue Palakis, who is one of Vito's freaks on the Laurel Canyon scene and became his wife at age 18. Today she takes us on an inside view of her life with Vito. On top of being a pioneer in modern dance and art, Sue is a forerunner of thrift store fashion, and there was always plenty of falling apart velvet dresses and 40s teddies available for pittance. Whatever she got tired of wearing, she put a price tag on. She also concocted her own creations out of doilies and tags, which cost a bit more, but were the ultimate in antique chic. Says Pamela's book, I'm with a Band, quote, Vito was convicted of armed robbery in 1938, but was released in 1942 and joined the U.S. Merchant Marines. Around 1946, he moved to Los Angeles, where, by the early 1960s, he had set up a home on Beverly Boulevard. Vito and Sue are some of the founding pioneers of what became the 60s counterculture revolution. And for more on this topic, please see Dave McGowan's full series, Inside the LC, which will be linked on the website to this article, as well as Dave's website, and also my own article with Joe Atwill, Manufacturing the Deadhead, a Product of Social Engineering. And also linked to this episode is the video where Sue discusses LSD, It's a Military Plot. And donations. This episode is brought to you by Deb, Samuel, and Paul. And while we do our best to provide just about everything here for free, your donations and website purchases are what keep Gnostic Media going. I ask that you please sign up for a donation or membership and help us continue doing what we do. And up there, we also accept Bitcoin donations. Please also check out the store page on the website where you may order our new Wheat Blows bumper stickers or bookmarks that have the fallacies on the back and our books, the Gnostic Media Archives, the She Who Remembers Archives, a DVD, Gnostic Media T-shirts, and memberships to the website to download the older podcasts. And as of next week or the next couple of weeks, we'll have the first 5 years of the Gnostic Media Podcast available on disk or a jump drive or something once we get it figured out. The views expressed by the authors and guests of this unprogram are their own and are not necessarily those held by myself, the host, or Gnostic Media. Check out the website at www.gnosticmedia.com. That's G-N-O-S-T-I-C media.com. You may contact me directly through the contact form on the website or at contact@gnosticmedia.com. Thanks for listening and thank you for your support. And here is my interview with Sue Palakis, Vito and the Freaks. Enjoy.
Well, so the interview will proceed. I did have this thing about the point, how wild it sounded about thinking Vito was associated with the CIA.
Oh, you thought that was wild, huh?
Yeah. I mean, anybody who knew him would just think that was the wildest thought.
Well, you know,
where did you get that thought from?
Well, we can go into that, but, you know, okay. as I mentioned yesterday, and we might as well start the interview now, so then we can talk about this issue, and then
sure.
We can just go right into it. But, Sue Palakis, welcome to the Gnostic Media Podcast. I'm happy to have you on. And
hello.
Hello. Well, you know, you and I were just talking about, you were saying that you thought that the idea of Vito possibly being CIA sounded crazy to you. So you wondered wherever I got that idea. So I might as well start off with that and then we'll dive into the interview here. But, you know, myself, I'm a researcher in MKUltra and my co-author. And then there's some other researchers like Dave McGowan that I mentioned to you yesterday. That have all been researching the origins of the counterculture and the music culture, the dance culture, centering around the ideas created in the early 1920s and 30s by Edward Bernays, who is the father of propaganda, and he sold specifically dance and sex and music and music idols, these sort of things, to guide the society in a direction that he wanted. And he worked with the key people such as Gordon Wasson, who's one of the key guys behind the psychedelic revolution that published the May 13, 1957 Life magazine article on magic mushrooms. And then that's where Leary supposedly learned of it and everything. But anyway, so when we look at the history of this, we find that like Jim Morrison, who was coming to Vito's shop in L.A., was the son of Admiral Morrison, who launched the Gulf of Tonkin incident and launched the Vietnam War. We have the Byrds, Buffalo Springfield, and the Crosby, Stills, and Nash, and a lot of these other bands directly out of the Laurel Canyon area associated with the art shop, Vito's art shop, and with the intelligence community and part of this agenda. So Vito seems to be sort of a nexus around a lot of this stuff, and I'm not the first one to, you know, come to this conclusion, but it seems that they wanted to sort of alter the art and dance scene in America. So the CIA was actually behind a lot of the modern art stuff that we see coming out of the 60s, they were, in fact, as we know from Edward Bernays' own writings, they were, in fact, trying to sort of recreate society in the way that they wanted it. Sort of, you know, they wanted to create a neo-feudalism or a new dark age, and they called it postmodernism. So that's where we get the idea from that Vito, whether or not he was aware of it, seems to have been a key person behind it. And then when you tell me that all of these agents and FBI and all of these informants are coming around, it, you know, either he had to have been an agent or he was being used by them for his talents. Does that make sense?
Well, they were intimidated by him because they had some fear of his power, and they wanted to be on top of the whole thing, like, what's he talking about now? Where is he going? What are his ideas?
Well, why do you think they were worried about him?
Well, he would get on to the networks, like the Joe Pyne Show. He was on the radio and the TV shows for Joe Pyne about four times each on each of those networks. And he spoke fluent Lithuanian to the head of KTLA, and there was kind of a friendship there. But the guy was later told by agents from Mayor Yorty's office that Vito would never be on KTLA again because of what he said on the Joe Pyne Show, which was innocent little things like girls that get pregnant when they're young, and instead of their parents jumping for joy that she, you know, achieved the state of reproduction, they were upset about it and wanting to end the pregnancy. So the powers didn't like stuff like that. They didn't like him talking about how, you know, you address your feelings about going into the Vietnam War when you were called up for service. And he would talk about that subject. And what?
Oh, I was saying, okay. Well, you know, Sue, I wanted to ask you, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself so that the audience knows who you are?
Well, today or before or when?
Well, both. How about that?
Start off with
the 60s and just, well, tell us who is Sue Palakis, and then, you know, let's just sort of go from there.
Okay, well, I grew up in at a school that was called the Venice Avenue Grammar School. It was across the street from the Polar Palace, where I spent many years ice skating and racer ice skating. And it was next door to the United Artists Studio, which was across the street from Paramount Studio and Western Costume Company. And then I went to LeConte Junior High, which was a wonderful thing. A lot of people in the movie business had their children go to that school. It was a wonderful experience in a public school. It was a model for public schools. And then I lived in the neighborhood that fed the Fairfax High School. And I went to Fairfax High, and then I was in the territory of the art theaters. And for movie theaters, we preferred going to these art theaters to see what they were showing. And they would show movies of the Holocaust. And then that kind of funneled me over into Vito's sculpture school. I wanted to have a class outside of regular school, and I'd always loved clay sculpture. So a girlfriend told me about his class, and I went there and loved it. And he had set the model for this type of school from his experience in Rome when he was on scholarship there to the Escuela della Bella Arte, where he spent a year. He brought that model back with him and dismantled his lamp-based manufacturing business in the basement of where he lived. And he started this art school in sculpture. And a lot of the young and upcoming stars love to hang out there or be a student in the class. And some of the fabulous artists, young artists of the time, like Paul...
Well, before we get too far into okay. Vito's place, why don't we talk okay. about your work at the
okay.
developmentally disabled hospital.
All right. Let's see. We moved up here the beginning of 69 to Sonoma County. Then we established a family of four children. We brought one child with us, and we had three more.
And you're talking about after you met Vito at the
yes,
art
after
school,
we
right?
were married, we had one child who lost
how,
his
how
life
long
in
after,
Los Angeles.
How long after you met were you married?
About a year and a half.
About a year and a half. And yeah.
So
and
it was like the,
go ahead.
Pardon?
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
And then we had our first child in 63. And that was about 4 years after we met. And with the move to Sonoma County, Vito built the first bandstand in the small town that we lived in out of wood from the chicken coops that were falling down around and not being used for chickens anymore. And then he developed a hernia. And in the early 70s, there was a problem in the operating on any kind of operation. They decided to do the breathing for the patient and with the tube down their throat to breathe for them. They hopefully got it into the lungs, but a lot of times they missed and got it into the stomach. And in his case, his lungs were very strong. And they missed getting it into through the bronchial sphincter, and it went to the stomach. So he basically died on the operating table and came back. They finally got him back, and it was hard to get him back, but he changed. His personality changed. He changed, became irritable. So I left, and I went back into college, which we had the Sonoma State University near us, and tried to develop a career, and I found myself finally in the profession of licensed psychiatric technician. And the job here in Sonoma County was one of the seven developmental disability hospitals of California. And I worked on a nursing, skilled nursing facility that was for the blind. And these were severely retarded, developmentally disabled clients that were about a year old of mental age. And it was very interesting scientifically. And I worked there 17 years. Now I'm retired. I loved the days we had in Los Angeles with Vito's art school, which was a kind of a center for communication of any kind of events, like if there would be like a large event at the Shrine Auditorium, then we would disseminate the word so people would know. They'd know when to meet. They'd meet at our place, and they'd caravan out with a lot of cars to the event. And it would involve dancing and rock and roll music. And so then on the other days, we would go up to the Sunset Strip or some neighborhood place that had a nice rock band and have a night there dancing. Since Vito was an ex-marathon dancer from the early 30s, he had danced 2 years sleeping standing up, and his body was just very well acquainted with the feeling of dancing for a while and pushing the blood through the body in that way. And that's the way we got high. We didn't get high on LSD.
Did you ever do drugs together?
No.
Never
we
did.
We smoked marijuana, so that was it.
You guys never did LSD or anything together, huh?
No.
Wow.
That's another misconception.
Well, let me ask you this. You were a you had mentioned to me that in our previous conversation that you were a manager of a school newspaper as well.
Yes.
And you said that you didn't feel right about doing that anymore, that you left doing newspapers and journalism?
That I what to newspapers and journalism?
You said that you left newspapers and journalism, that you didn't like it?
Well, I did it for 2 years, and that's the point at which I switched over into psychiatric technician. I was on campus. I'd heard about how they would give quite a bit of money for going into that program, and on your off days when you weren't at school, you needed to be working for the state hospital, and then you would earn this amount of money. And I, being as I could become a part of the school newspaper, I could research and find out if any other program was offering such a thing as the $1,300 a month to go into this program, and there wasn't anything else on the campus like that. So a friend of mine who also used to live in, it was from Los Angeles and moved up here, wanted to go in that program, and it's always a good idea to go in these programs with a buddy. And so we did that, and he knew about this job out at the state hospital, and I was able to get that job. And So the whole thing of Vito being some kind of underground agent that was reporting on people
new. We never said that he was reporting on people. The issue is, as you said, that the studio was central, that they disseminated the information about all going on, that all of these important people and stars were coming around there. But interestingly, when we get into Edward Bernays's work, there were several things, and you had mentioned yesterday to me in our conversation that, you know, a couple of the things that he was promoting sort of were sort of sex and the dancing, right?
Right.
Right. So, you know, what we have found is that, and this is from our research, in 1913, Edward Bernays was hired to protect a play that supported sex education, and they had to block the police interference. So Edward Bernays set up this big event, okay, and then they had dancers and everything go do this, and then when people attacked it, he would PR it. It was all a setup, and then they would publish things like in the New York Times saying, "It is 6 o'clock in America," and the idea was to change people's ideas of how they perceived these things in society. So, you know, for instance, you knew Jim Morrison. Okay, so, you know, and like I said, Jim Morrison was the son of Admiral Morrison, who launched the Vietnam War. But when we look at Edward Bernays, he produced the performances of Vaclav Nijinsky, who had mimed masturbation on stage, just as Morrison did, and he caused outrage. And then Bernays says, quote, "The whole country was discussing the ballet," he said, and then, quote, "The ballet liberated American dance, and through it, the American spirit." And it fostered a more tolerant view towards sex. So, you know, but Bernays was CIA. They were, like I said earlier, they were fostering an idea, sort of a breakdown of the culture. And when we look at one thing, just dance, maybe we don't see it. But if we step back and we look at all of these things that they were using through the 60s counterculture, through the music, etc., then we can see this this thing going on. So, you know, when we consider that Vito was into dance, and here Bernays is using dance for this, and then we see Vito was involved, and you know, the, you know, Jim Morrison and the Byrds and Buffalo Springfield, and you know, Frank Zappa and all of these characters came around. Frank Zappa was the son of an intelligence officer from Edgewood, Maryland, where they did a lot of the chemical warfare stuff. And so we can actually see this going on. Now, furthermore, another thing that Bernays created was the music idol. and he actually helped create that. So then we see the spawning of all of these big 60s music idols right out of Laurel Canyon and right around Vito's store there. So Bernays says human beings need to have Godhead symbols, and public relations councils must help to create them. And Bernays goes on to say that he saw idol making as vital to the salvation of society. Quote, "We have no being in the air to watch over us. We must watch over ourselves, and that is what public relations counselors can prove their effectiveness by making the public believe that human gods are watching over us for our own benefit." And then he goes on and talks about creating the music idol and the pop star, which is, again, all of these people surrounding around the store and this changing of the art. But he says, he manufactures the first, basically, pop star, who is Enrico Caruso. And he says, quote, "The overwhelming majority of the people who reacted spontaneously to Caruso had never heard of him before. The public's ability to create its own heroes from wisps and impressions and its own imagination and to build them into almost flesh and blood gods fascinated me. Of course, I knew the ancient Greeks and their other civilized peoples had done this. But now it was happening before my eyes in contemporary America." So we can actually go back and look at Bernays' writings and see that this was the actual agenda that he was using. And then, of course, he's working with Henry Luce at Time Life. He's working with Gordon Wasson, the discoverer of magic mushrooms. And he's working with other key people that were behind MKUltra and promoting these ideas. So, you know, when we look at the Mamas and the Papas and Jimi Hendrix and the Grateful Dead, the Byrds, Buffalo Springfield, all of these bands that were centered right around Vito, you know, and Vito also had LA's first crash pad where all of these people all went to and hung out as well.
Okay, but they didn't crash there.
Why was it called LA's first crash pad?
I never heard it called that. They were calling places in San Francisco crash pads because they would all live there.
Well, I think, you know, maybe it was before you got together with him or something, but apparently he had the first crash pad in LA, in the LA area. So there's, you know, some write-up on that and people talking about hanging out at Vito's place there.
So, yeah, but hanging out is different from sleeping. See, he would lock the door every day at 4 o'clock to have a nap.
Oh, I see.
And so that would get people out.
Oh, okay. So, but they were all just coming around and hanging out there anyway. It was kind of a central place. You know, and see, all of these
mostly
connections...
Mostly at night.
Huh?
Mostly at night.
Mostly at night. Okay, maybe that's
because
where...
his classes were at night.
Gotcha.
And after his class, then he would go off to some dance or a party and then come back and go to bed. But there'd be that time interval of the class and the previous to going out to some party or dance. There'd be a collection of people assembling as he finished up with his class. And the class didn't necessarily overlap into going to the party, but some of them did.
Okay, gotcha. So, go ahead.
Yeah, none of them slept at his place.
Okay. Now, you had stated that in the 1960s, or actually in the 1960s, there was a video of you on some TV show, maybe it was the BBC, had interviewed you and Vito about all of this, and you had stated that you thought that LSD was a CIA plot to undermine the culture. What do you say about that today?
Maybe that was, you know, correct thinking of trying to uncover where this was coming from, that there was such an abundance of something that threw people's thinking off into a realm of fantasy and disconnectedness.
Right.
But now we have the methamphetamine culture.
I was just going to ask you about that.
Okay, and I feel that the Japanese, the old guard Japanese from World War II, never gave up, and that they decided to attack the Allies in a different way. And since they had invented methamphetamines, they funneled it into this country, and now it's just taken off. It's so addictive. And
well, what do you think about our own government using drugs to control the population that way? I mean, just as it is suggested that the CIA used LSD, they could also use meth, right?
Well, they use alcohol, too.
Oh, sure. Of course.
And that's been made legal. It was under prohibition, it was illegal.
Well, but under prohibition, it just went completely out of control, so... Well, you know, yesterday you had talked to me about Vito. He had won an award on the Groucho Marx show called the Magic Word Award, and he won $5,000.
Yes.
Okay, so what was that about?
Well, he said the magic word. I never knew what that word was. And then he received the money. And
Now, $5,000, what year was that?
55.
So you're talking a... quite a large sum of money there.
Yeah.
Yeah, so in 55, that would probably be, you know, $50,000 today.
Okay. It was enough money for him to have his dream of going to Europe to look at the museums and go through Europe. And then he spoke fluent Sicilian Italian, so it was natural that he would settle in Italy.
And you said he spoke Latvian as well?
Lithuanian.
Lithuanian. Okay, so he was multilingual as well. And
yes.
And then he gets the Escuela della Bella Arte of Rome.
Escuela della Bella Arte.
Thank you.
Rome. He got the scholarship there for a year to study clay sculpture. And then he brought that model back to Los Angeles and established it in his studio that he had as a lamp-based manufacturing business.
So,
but in regards to what you were saying about these rock stars that had fathers that were in the military.
Sure.
I had a boyfriend for 15 years whose father was a bird colonel in the Army in Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
And his brother was a medic. And he was a very talented... My boyfriend, Ken Shaddy, was a talented musician on Stratocaster.
Right.
Stratocaster... he could play Pipeline perfectly, and he'd been in Germany for his tour of duty for 3 years studying dental technology, and he'd been with the band Yes, and he gave them their name, Yes, and they wanted him to stay because he was such a talented musician and lead rock guitarist, and he... spoke fluent German, which he'd learned at schools in the United States, but he was born there on a German base. His father was had been in World War II, and he continued on in the military to the point where now he was a colonel in Vietnam. And when I met him, his father had been in retirement, and Ken had developed a very serious case of schizophrenia. And so that gave me that basis that I needed to go into the psychiatric technician field and investigate what schizophrenia was and how come these new medications worked on that kind of stuff.
And interestingly, a lot of those medications came out of the LSD research that was going on at the time that you warned everybody on TV about back then. So, so what happened when Vito came back from Rome? Why don't we talk about the studio on Sunset? And, you know, so he gets back and it was a lamp studio. He changes that, but let's go on from there.
Okay, it was near Beverly Boulevard. It was the bottom part of Laurel Canyon, that extends down through Los Angeles to the south. And it was actually on Laurel Avenue. And what was it you wanted to know about?
Oh, just talk about the studio and everything, you know, when he started setting that up after
the Birds actually moved into the house next door to
us. Who did?
The Birds.
Oh, the Birds. Okay.
Yeah, and we had the war protesting going on at that time, and
and you lived on in Laurel Canyon, right?
No, we had friends that eventually moved into the Tom Mix house in Laurel Canyon, and the Houdini house across the street from the Tom Mix house in Laurel Canyon. We lived on the southernmost part of Laurel, which was Laurel Avenue.
Gotcha.
That extended down to Beverly Boulevard and even more south, going south, 3rd Street, 6th Street, Wilshire. It might have ended at Wilshire, I'm not quite sure. And we lived at Beverly Boulevard and Laurel Avenue. So it was quite a ways down from Laurel Canyon. But
so what was it like living next door to the Birds?
Well, we told them about, we gave them the space in the art school studio during the day to rehearse. And they had just gotten together. Mike Clark on drums had never played drums before. And
Mike,
so they
he
were
had never played drums before? So how does he become
right.
a musician in a big band if he had never played before?
He just had a knack for it. He played little sticks on the ground and...
That's interesting, playing sticks on the ground to going to be a big rock star. But, I mean, see, this is why so many of these people coming out of Laurel Canyon are under question, because they have no prior music experience. Many of them are not just sons and daughters of military, but actually sons and daughters of an intelligence people. You know, like, let me give you another example. Stuart Copeland of the band Police. He's the son of, I'm just looking at this, but it was Stuart Copeland Sr., whatever, but anyway, the drummer of the band The Police is the son of the founder of the OSS and co-founded the CIA. You know,
okay.
But you know, it's not just like this. Like I said, Frank Zappa was out. His dad was a chemical weapons manufacturer out of Edgewood Arsenal in Maryland. We have, you know, the Birds were included in this, and they were living next door to you guys, like you just said. Buffalo Springfield, Mamas and Papas, Jimi Hendrix, Grateful Dead, on down the list. So, you know, what we have here, and then like I quoted you earlier, Bernays and the intelligence community, they were creating this rock and roll scene and this art scene. And whether or not Vito was aware of it, or, you know, I mean, obviously they could have used him, or he could have possibly just never mentioned it to you as well. You were much younger than him, and maybe he felt it was better that you didn't know.
About what?
About all of these intel people around. But, you know, you obviously knew.
Well, my father was a secret worker on the stealth airplane out of Lockheed. And, you know, everybody had stuff like that. There was a big gaping opening during the Vietnam War of certain factions, like the guys were gone. So who were the guys that were left?
Did you know there was a secret movie studio right there in Laurel Canyon that was run by the government?
No.
Yeah, there is one there. And so, you know, it's Laurel Canyon seems to really be a center of a lot of this stuff. And, you know, a lot of people are just waking up to this. But Dave McGowan was the primary guy who first started exposing this. And we started digging through it as well, and were able to verify his connections with these people. So, I mean, it's very possible that they just use you guys. But, you know, he gets this award on the Groucho Marx show. He goes to Rome. He comes back. He creates this studio that suddenly is the center of all of these people in the intel community around there who were promoting these very things. Now, many of them may not
have
been...
Well, it was just a coincidence. With, like, say, the group with the Birds, half of them were these innocent young guys, and then there you had Jim McGuinn, who you said was somebody whose father was in intelligence community. Who was the other guy with Jim, who changed his name to Roger, Roger McGuinn?
I don't remember.
Who was the other guy? There was another guy with Roger McGuinn.
I don't remember.
Bird.
I don't
but
remember.
Then you had Gene Clark was the singer. He played the castanets.
You never David, thought it was interesting how these bands that really didn't have a whole lot of musical experience just suddenly became huge?
You know, they came out with Mr. Tambourine Man.
Right.
And some of the young high school girls who would come over and hang out after school would call in like time after time after time to the station, kept on requesting that one song because they knew we had given the space to them to rehearse in, and we'd given them their first job, which was to play for an anti-Vietnam party. And later Vito was busted for having underagers at an adult dance, and evidently there was a law on the book that said you couldn't have underage kids at a dance with overage people unless you had a bona fide legal president, vice president, secretary, treasurer, and minutes taken at meetings. So that would allow you then to be considered in a group where you could have underage people at a dance.
And then there were these war protests going on. But do you also think it's interesting that that you guys are having these war protests? Meanwhile, Jim Morrison is hanging around and his dad launched the whole war?
We didn't know that about Jim Morrison. He was one of these guys that was a symbol with the long hair and the kind of draggy, slouchy, drugged out manner that people wanted that symbol.
Well, that's what we're saying. Right, and that's what
protest.
We're saying is that whole image was actually sold.
Yeah. Well, it was just that it might have been sold, but it was a phenomenon of the baby boomers coming out of their homes at that time and facing the terror of going off to uncertain death. And
right, but that his own dad created. Do you see the irony there?
Well, that's true. I mean, many of these guys, Ken, you know.
He becomes the idol or the look of the people who are in fear and reacting to the war that his own father created. Do you see the problem there?
Well, I've always wondered about how much these officers had a part in creating that war, which was said to be started under the Kennedy administration, although Kennedy may not have had much to do with it.
Sure, but Morrison's own dad, who launched the Gulf of Tonkin incident that got us into the war,
I watched the news on the Vietnam War every day of my life.
Sure,
and that was his dad. The Gulf of Tonkin was way into the Vietnam War. It wasn't the beginning of it.
The Gulf of Tonkin is what got us officially into the Vietnam War.
Well, it escalated it, but as far as officially into it, we were already into it.
Sure, well,
since
I mean, but officially, you know, we were, you know, that's what officially pulled us into the war is the Gulf of Tonkin incident. That's well known. But it was Admiral Morrison who did that, and Admiral Morrison was Jim Morrison's father. And then Jim Morrison becomes the poster boy and look of the anti-war movement that his own dad created. I mean, it doesn't make sense. It's too much coincidence. You know, you know, we're talking about something that just is so obvious when you see.
Well,
what does make sense is that he was intentionally selling that look and everything, and that he and a lot of these other guys, as we know now, were in intel. You know, so they were creating that idol look, that music idol look that I just mentioned in the quote from Edward Bernays. They wanted to create that look. He's selling the Oedipus complex and his... in his music, he's miming the masturbation on stage and all
Oedipus
of this stuff.
Oedipus complex about sure. his mother, you mean?
Yes.
What was that?
That was in the song The End. Do you remember that?
Well, those kind of songs just sort of hit me the wrong way.
Well, exactly, but that was the idea, you see. He was actually selling uh-huh. these ideas that Edward Bernays had created. And it's exactly in his lyrics. In the end, he says, "The killer awoke before the dawn. He put his boots on. He took a face from the ancient gallery, and he walked on down the hall. He went to the room where his sister lived, and then he paid a visit to his brother, and then he walked on down the hall. And he came to the door, and he looked inside. Father, yes, son, I want to kill you. Mother, I want to, wah!" You know? That is the Oedipus complex.
Uh-huh. Okay, so, but you're relating that to Jim Morrison.
Right, well, Jim Morrison...
Just because he sang that song?
What I'm saying is that... No, what I'm saying is that he was Admiral Morrison's son. Okay, they are selling this whole meme. Edward Bernays admits that they created the music rock idols of the 60s. All of these music idols and everything... they create to give people something to keep distracted with, essentially, so that they, you know, the intelligence and everything does what they do. And then they put out these distractions or these music idols to lead the society in the way that they want. So they have the uninhibited dancing, okay, which, as uh-huh. you know, Vito promoted. They have the overt right. sexual images, okay, which that was promoted, as we talked about earlier and yesterday.
Well, this uninhibited dancing, it kind of did grow out of that Nijinsky ballet.
Exactly. For see, you, that's exactly, mm-hmm. so you, that, you're exactly right.
I was one of those. Yeah, I was wild about Nijinsky.
Well, see, Nijinsky was, Bernays set that whole thing up. That was all social control. Bernays admits in his writings that he intentionally spun that for the public. Nijinsky uh-huh. was a setup for the people. He was like a fraud. You know, he was intentionally promoted uh-huh. by Edward Bernays to the public to manipulate everybody in the direction that he wanted.
Uh-huh.
And this is in Edward Bernays' own writings that he admits that he did this. So, you know, Vaclav uh-huh. Nijinsky, he was a key part of this stuff. And then later on, you see... Jim Morrison mimicking the exact same things. And of course, we had Edward Bernays behind the scenes. And then Edward Bernays was also working with Gordon Wasson, who popularized magic mushrooms in 1956. Gordon Wasson was actually the vice president of propaganda for J.P. Morgan Bank. So, you know, they essentially like, you know, they fooled everybody is what we're getting at. And the issue is, essentially, was Vito aware of it, or was he basically a patsy? You know, did they use him sort of like a willful idiot or something? You know, because he wants to do his art and his music and all of this stuff, and then all of a sudden the intelligence community is piggybacking on top of him.
Well, Vito believed in social commentary, and he put that into his sculpture. And he had a whole show in the early 60s of social commentary. They had this anniversary of the four little girls that were killed in Alabama with a bomb in their church. He had a sculpture of one of those children that was a beautiful sculpture with an image of an older man behind the girl that was representing the United States. And then there was a placard that was in the sculpture that itemized who, you know, these people were, to make it more specific. He was truly one of the United States or the world's great 20th century artists. and he was interested in art, but he was equally as interested in dance. And if you're talking about altering your consciousness and getting high, there's nothing as great as a couple of hours of dancing to do that. And anything that would stop that from happening, like somebody like Jim Morrison, who had a very, his dancing, his music was very hard to dance to. I had to go up there and be a solo act on the floor at the Trip at 9:30 at night. And
why did you have to go up there?
Well, because it was my designated time to leave my baby with my husband so I could have a couple of an hour out to dance.
Right.
And I would get on, there wouldn't be anybody on the dance floor. I'd have to be on the dance floor alone. And I had a dress shop at the time. I was making all handmade original dresses, so I would have some wild creation on. And it would be a show, and hopefully it wouldn't be Jim Morrison. Hopefully it would be the Gauchos or the Kinks from England or the Electric Prunes or Donovan.
So you never saw any of that as staged and intentionally promoting the dress and the, you know, what later became this sort of deadhead look and dance? You don't see any connection between those events?
This deadhead look and dance, that's a new term for me, so
well,
I don't
great,
know what
you know, the Grateful Dead,
to.
Sort of, you know, the deadhead, they wear the tie-dye and all of this stuff.
Yeah,
I mean,
they played at the 67 free the Love-In at Elysian Park. The Grateful Dead played there just before we took the stage, and we were called the oh gosh, I can't remember that. But,
you were the Freaks, weren't you?
No, it was. I'll think of it later, but it was just basically a collaboration of musicians and dancers, and the sound was unplugged when we took the stage. And so basically all you could hear is the drums and the saxophone and us dancing. And everybody in the audience, there was 25,000 people there, thought it was that was part of the whole stage thing, to look different from the Grateful Dead, who'd just been on previous to us.
Uh-huh.
So,
well, what we're talking about
the Wildflowers. I think they were called the Wildflowers.
Okay.
Calling ourselves the Wildflowers.
Right. Well, what we're talking about is the creating of the music idols, the entire sexual dancing, all of this stuff is all tied together there. And when we.
Well, there was no sexuality in the dancing.
Well,
that was the whole thing.
We were just talking about like Jim Morrison and Vaclav Nijinsky and all of this stuff. That's
well, he might have been implying that. I just never understood it, you know, because I couldn't hear his lyrics anyway.
Well, what about
even though I was standing right in front of him?
What about when Vito dodged the house on Un-American Activities? What can you tell us about that?
Not much, because there wasn't anything to it. It was just that they were, you know, striking out about onto people's jobs in the community, trying to dislodge them from their jobs in the community by defacing them with this term, communist. You're a communist.
Well, isn't a communist a specific sort of political idealism? And you said that he had sort of communist leanings. Is that why they were after him?
Yeah.
Okay. So they came by and they interviewed him about?
Well, you know, just to recognize that, you know, things that we live with in our everyday society are part of the communist ideology.
Well,
like,
sure, I get that, but that's large.
The roads that the government pays for, the schools the government pays for. Even the institution of marriage is something everybody participates
in. Well, that's actually because people fall into giving up their consent on these things, and they're sort of fooled into that. But when you go back to the 1800s, et cetera, we have sovereigns. But you know what they've done is they've tricked people into accepting marriage licenses, et cetera, which actually right before this show goes out, I'll be releasing a show on marriage and the whole marriage license issue.
Mm.
But, you know, this is, you know, every culture you're allowed to get married. There's no reason to get a license for it. They can't tell you that you can't be married or live together or anything if you don't get this license. The license, all you're doing is bringing the government into your marriage. And all you have to do is not consent to it. Just don't sign the stupid license, and then you're not a part of it. All you have to do is just sign it in your family Bible or whatever.
Yeah. Well, that's the modern thinking. Well, in my day, in order for a girl to get out of the house, she had to have that license to show her father, you know?
Yeah.
So she could be released from her house.
Sure. Well, let's get into, you know, the you said that Vito had a lot of FBI informants coming around to speak with him. Do you want to talk about that?
Well, it was just something that you subtly became aware of. Somebody might tell you, oh, there was a man in your class tonight who had a gun hidden down in his boots, and he was a black man, but there was no reason for him to be there other than that he was a paid informant. And later on, I was able to check that out at a meeting for continuing education I went to in Sonoma County, where I saw that man again. And he was a member of the police force, and so he was there to listen in on what Vito had to say. And Vito was very vocal and verbal, and he kept up a good conversation all through his class. So it was always very interesting to be in his class, because people would be working on their sculptures and they wouldn't be in conversation with another person. They'd just be quiet. But Vito would be the one that would be orating these wonderful tales of whatever he was talking about. And a lot of it had to do with the news that was on TV that night. And it was always good fodder for the community that came down to his class.
Why do you think Vito was working in the directions towards sexuality and drug use?
He wasn't working in the direction of drug use.
Well, you had mentioned, you know, those were things that were really, I mean, he wasn't doing them, but you mentioned yesterday that he was sort of, you know, promoting things in that direction. Why do you suppose that was?
I didn't mention that. You did.
Okay.
He wasn't promoting anything in the direction of drug use. As a matter of fact, he stood up at a meeting with O'Leary at a canyon meeting out in the woods where a lot of people came to hear Dennis O'Leary talk about the use of LSD and how it could expand the consciousness. And Vito had to stand up to take the other side of the debate.
You're talking about Tim Leary.
Tim.
Yeah.
And Vito made the point that you needed to have your wits about you when you created art in order that everything went right. You couldn't be doing this with a different consciousness that was promoted by drugs. So he gave the other side of the debate that needed to be heard when Tim Leary spoke out about the benefits of using LSD.
And here is that clip from yesterday's conversation.
And it switched over to the FBI informants, who were paid people that were sent out on investigations that they were assigned to and had to report whatever they found out. And they were told to find out, you know, work in certain directions, like work in directions of sexuality, in directions of drug use, things that would be illegal.
And they were pushing or sort of promoting that direction, or what were they doing?
Well, that's
you're hitting on exactly what we discovered, so this is perfect.
Yeah, until I finally came to the conclusion that there was this huge army of these paid informants that I became aware of.
Tim Leary admitted in 78 or 79 that he was, in fact, an agent.
Yes, that's true. And the 70s marked that period in music of disco. And they brought that disco in with this big surge of the Vietnam War.
And cocaine.
And the devastation to the counterculture, a kind of music that was undanceable. The disco, it was, you know, had its kind of, when you think of John Travolta, I think more of a kind of a jitterbug type of dance than a disco dance, and that made it danceable. But a lot of the disco music just was undanceable, and that kind of ruined what had started off from the previous history of music in the United States in the 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s. All of a sudden you get to the 70s and you've got music you can't dance to now. And then it just got worse with this hard rock.
Well, that's what others would say, even, you know, just as much about the acid rock of the 60s, that you couldn't dance to it. But
well, wait a minute. I don't remember any acid rock of the 60s.
Well, acid being the music that came out of LSD, acid, you know, like the Grateful Dead can be considered acid rock of the 60s.
Yeah, but they were not danceable, the Grateful Dead.
Right. All right, what about, let me ask you about the Freaks. What can you tell us about the Freaks?
Who were they?
Well, the Freaks were the group of people that Vito danced with.
Well, okay. People like me.
Right. They were called the, you know, it was Vito and the Freaks,
okay,
is what others called
them. I had the background
them.
in racing, ice skating, swimming, a lot of walking, dance classes at school, and paying attention to interpreting music with the body and dancing and rhythm. And then having the dress shop that my husband created for me. Vito put together that dress shop in a skillfully designer-decorated way that helped make it a focal point for people that were lost and looking for a life. And we didn't really offer them anything other than going to a party at night. So now your question had to do with
what went on at these parties at night.
Hopefully dancing. If it was a bar scene, like some kind of scene on the Sunset Strip, like the Crescendo, where there was a bar and a dance floor and a stage, we never bought a drink. We would buy a Coke. And,
so you never got intoxicated, you were never on any drugs, but then you went out and acted all of these things. I mean, it, you know, doesn't it seem strange? It seems a little set up to me.
It's the kind of intoxication that comes from dancing for a couple of hours.
Well, I mean the whole thing about going out there and then promoting these ideas and these bands and then creating the dance around them and everything, doesn't it all seem a little bit too worked, too staged?
The dance was already there before the groups were there. I'm kind of losing my flow.
Here's another short clip from our previous conversation. And in this one, notice where she says she had to dance for Jim Morrison.
So then this new era began, and that probably was about 61, when you got the Whiskey A Go Go opened out of a coffee house that was a kind of beatnik poetry and coffee type place. And the Galaxy opened next door to that eventually, and the Cloister turned into the Trip, and they got these guys from different countries like England to come over and play there. And Jim Morrison just happened to be one of those bands that came into play there, which we were always regretting when we had to go dance with him, because it was very hard to dance that kind of slow, draggy music with no rhythm.
What about, you know, but I mean, we know these bands come in that we know are the, you know, out of the intelligence community, etc. And then they're all coming around Vito's shop, and then he's going around to all of these clubs promoting the dance around these same bands. You've got the birds living next door to you, etc. I mean, doesn't it just seem a little too easy?
Easy to what?
Right. I mean, you know, if you were to look at your friends, for instance, you know, I mean, I've known dozens of bands throughout my life, and none of them have made it big, but you knew bands that just about all of them became huge classic rock hits, all of them, across the board.
I didn't know them.
Well, you knew the Birds, you knew the Doors, you knew...
Well, we just coincidentally
knew Frank Zappa,
a band that...
You knew all
okay.
of these... Go ahead.
We had a friend who had a business that went out of business, and he decided to be a go-between between a group, a likely group, like, say, the Mothers.
Right.
To coordinate where an event would take place, like the Santa Monica Civic Auditorium. He told the Mothers, he found out from the Mothers that they had been asked to come over there and play. So then he came, he was our friend, so he came to us and he said, we've been invited to go over to the Santa Monica Civic Auditorium and dance. And so then the Mothers, feeling like this was a big chance for them to get known, hired 6 union musicians. Well, we already were hanging around with guys that were union musicians that came out of the 50s. And so we thought, wow, that's great. They're giving jobs to union musicians. And then we went out to the dance, and the guy who was throwing it was the heir to the Green Chip stamp fortune.
Interesting. What about, you know, wasn't Vito related to, who was it? Wasn't he related to Winthrop Rockefeller?
No.
He wasn't?
No, not at all. Both of his parents came from Lithuania and worked in the linen mills,
okay,
and they were married at the age of 13.
Wasn't his cousin the wife of Winthrop Rockefeller?
Not that I ever heard of. His cousin? No.
Yeah, his
no,
first...
No. I don't think that's correct at all.
His first cousin, it looks like... Let me see. I'm just looking this up. Eva Paul.
No. No.
Okay. What about, you had said that yesterday that it didn't escape you the possibility that you had all of these agents around you, and that was part of the reason why you left to Sebastopol, was to get away from some of that. Would you talk about that?
Well, the political mood of Los Angeles, the late 50s and 1960 in particular, was Mayor Yorty and Chief of Police Parker. Parker went to the South, recruited 200 rookie policemen to come into L.A. and kind of terrorize L.A. with people that were on the street. And the Sunset Strip, and I don't know much about the history of why it went black and why Ciro's was out of business and all these nightclubs were down and out, and the only place to go to was up a back staircase to a place on the top of the building called the Crescendo, and that was being run by Gene Norman, who preceded Dick Clark with the TV shows and the kids dancing on the TV shows. Later on, that nightclub became the Playboy Club, and downstairs had been the Cloister, and that's where the biggest jazz musicians played, and that became the Trip, where the British Invasion groups came to, at the same time that the Whiskey Go-Go had opened in a coffee shop that had been a beatnik hangout for poetry. And
all of this stuff just happened at the same time, right?
Well, it had been blacked out, and then it sort of changed. That's when the change came in, with the new modern music. At first,
sure. What,
was
what if
jazz.
What if that change came that came in was intentional?
If it was intentional.
Right, I mean, you know, marketed, sold. You know, when you get into the background, you look at the comments that Edward Bernays made about marketing all of these ideas, and then you see it all of a sudden come in, and it sort of just happens, sort of simultaneously. Have you ever considered that that was all sort of marketed or staged?
I haven't considered that idea, but I will.
You had stated that someone else had called you asking similar questions as myself.
Oh, I don't remember that.
Right. So what about the mafia on the Sunset Strip?
I don't know too much about it, other than a child of people involved with the mafia of Los Angeles ended up at Sonoma State running a KSUN, K-S-U-N, a radio station, and
right.
asked me to come in and be interviewed. Maybe that's what you're referring to. And had he just knew the right questions to ask, because he was a child that came out of that time in that place.
Right.
And so the whole interview went real smoothly.
Would you talk about how you had mentioned that you were named, your group was named after one of the art streets downtown. Did you ever remember what that was? In
art
LA?
Art Street?
Yeah, you had a group of dancers and artists that were named after one of the big art streets in downtown Los Angeles.
Oh, okay. The La Cienega group.
Ah, okay.
I think that's what, maybe it wasn't even La Cienega. The Heights, Crescent Heights, was a street we were closer to. But I think they referred to us as the La Cienega group, because we would go every Monday night. We would go over to all of the art receptions on La Cienega Boulevard. And I had a one-woman show there one time too.
So what were you successful. What were you doing at all of those art clubs? Were you showing up and dress and dance?
No, we would just go to view the art, and we were there for the opening of the Campbell's Soup exhibit with what was his name? The Campbell's Soup cans.
I don't remember. I know what you're talking about, but I don't
okay.
remember his name.
Okay.
Interesting.
It'll come to me in a minute.
Right after we're
but
done.
We
with
were,
the interview,
I was right? I was very shocked by that, you know, to see those soup cans painted. But people were doing stuff like that at that time.
Yeah.
My stuff is more in the vein of portraiture, and so I had an exhibit too at that time, and. It was always a real wonderful and fun event to go walk along the boulevard and drop into every single gallery, one after the other after the other. And there might have been 30 galleries there.
Interesting. So is
you
there...
You know, at the time...
Go ahead.
...too, when the Wilshire Museum opened on Wilshire Boulevard, the new museum, we went to the opening of that. Mm-hmm. That was about 64 or 65.
What about your husband would you like people to think about or remember about him?
His artistry, his natural ability with art. He had the most beautiful mosaics of Los Angeles came out of his studio, and he would design them according to what his student wanted to do. If his student wanted to do an underwater treasure box with fish floating around in the water around it, he would draw that out, paint it the different colors, and then have the tiles ready for the people when they came to the class to start gluing the tiles into the different areas and turn out a beautiful mosaic, as well as the clay sculpture. That part of his classes, which were on different nights, and he also had dance classes in his studio, so we could learn the moves and be able to interpret the music with the different body moves and not just be kind of limply flying around without knowing what we were doing.
Right. Now, you had originally gone to him because you were interested in sculpture. So what got you into the dancing after that?
Well, I was going to school, and I had always taken physical education courses, and I had the choice to take dance classes, and always been a kind of a leader in my school as far as going to different dances, like square dances. I started off in grammar school with minuet, and I'm still continuing with minuet to this day. I go to an English country dance here in Sonoma County, and that's caught on throughout the United States. There's a lot of groups that have English country dance that grew eventually into square dance. So I enjoy that.
So that was another meme that sort of was created out of Vito's dancing, would you say?
No, his dancing, he was interested in Afro moves, and he took Archie Savage's class, and he tried to think of contracting the body and then releasing. It was kind of an Isadora Duncan, modern Martha Graham school of thought on dance. That's where he was coming from. I had other things behind what I was doing. I went to a meditation class at the Church of Religious Science on 6th and Normandy, where I learned deep breathing, and I would use that deep breathing in my dance to accentuate the moves I was doing and to bring the air into my body and expel it in a rhythmic way to inspire other people to get up and dance. But I was consciously thinking of moving in a direction, and I sort of joined with Vito, and we kept on going to modern dance classes, and that was a part of our life every week. So we would expand our knowledge of body moves that we could make, and I was already a student of ice skating and ice racing, so I liked to move around a big floor, and I did that easily.
Do you know about the influence of the CIA on modern art?
Well, I don't know what artist you would be referring to.
Well, there was, they just sort of create or influence the whole modern art sort of movement, etc. Do you know about that?
Well, they grew out of the post-war, World War II. CIA came out of that era.
No, I mean the modern art specifically coming out of the CIA. The CIA basically helped to promote and push those ideas.
Okay, I was unaware of that.
I have a good article on it somewhere. Maybe I'll have to mail it to you.
Okay. Well, insofar as abstract art is devoid of social commentary, maybe the CIA would be in favor of that.
Well, it was more of a getting all of the arts away from the classical forms and back to more tribal forms so that they could sell this postmodernist neo-feudalism that they were going for. So, they would incorporate all of these different types of tribal dancing and music and all of these things as a way to hopefully degrade the society. Whether, I think it worked on some levels, on other levels it didn't, but it seems clear that that was the overall agenda there.
so to degrade the society,
right, which
by
was
kind of ripping off their music.
Well, no, not by
rhythm.
Ripping off their music. It was, you know, what they would do is they would use the overt sexual images in the media and the sexual dancing, and then promote the psychedelic drugs, and then promote sort of shamanism and ancient cultural ideas to sort of set the society in a mindset that the ancient or the archaic was better than anything new or modern.
And when you say ancient, what are you referring to there? How far ancient?
Well, I mean, even like, you know, well, their idea is to sort of create a new dark age, so let me put it that way.
Well, I had the wonderful experience of dancing with people that were born in the early part of the 20th century. My partner was born in 1903 in southern Spain, and he knew all of the beautiful dances that he learned as a young teenager in Spain, and then he came to live in Brooklyn. And I found him at the senior ballroom dance in Sonoma County and had him for about 5 or 6 years, where we were with a large group of people that just relished foxtrotting. And so that's mainly what we did for 3 hours once a week, was foxtrot. And it, as simple as that sounds, like slow, quick, quick, slow, quick, quick, slow, quick, quick, it's very hard to get that pattern down in the mind so that you don't even have to think about it. You could just talk while you're dancing. Well, I accomplished that after about 3 years. And it's today would be considered an ancient dance. But to me, it was the key to unlocking the beautiful music interpretation of these music that came out of the 20s, 30s, and 40s, and that Fred Astaire did when you wouldn't know he was doing foxtrot, but it was just part of his brain.
What about you were saying that somebody, someone had promoted or taught the wrong
version? Arthur Murray was teaching foxtrot as slow, slow, quick, quick, slow, slow, quick, quick, which is completely different than foxtrot, which is slow, quick, quick, slow, quick, quick. Slow, quick, quick is a 4-beat rhythm, but when you add 2 more beats with an extra slow, it changes it from a 4-beat rhythm to a 6-beat rhythm. So it's not the same thing, and the body falls differently too in your stepping, so that your body tires out with that kind of a rhythm. With that kind of a dance move on the dance floor. And with the foxtrot, made it possible for a person to be a part of the marathon dancing and dance unendingly, because your body didn't tire out. It had equal weight on either side of your body when you did that move. And it also was able to interpret the music beautifully. If you watch Fred Astaire, the way he could interpret music, and that's the way foxtrot is. It allows the person to interpret any music. Grace Slick's Jefferson Airplane stuff with the beautiful tango rhythm of one pill makes you smaller, one pill makes you tall. White Rabbit song was just a beautiful tango.
Sure, but of course these were all drug themes, though, even in the lyrics that you just mentioned.
Yeah, so, but it grew out of a fairy tale.
Well, a fairy tale based on drugs.
Drugs,
Lewis Carroll.
Drugs. Right. Yeah.
So what is the single most important thing that you would like people to take away from this conversation and your and Vito's work together?
The concept of dancing alone, as we did in the 60s and 70s, the John Travolta kind of era, versus the holding another person, I think needs to be considered for the people, the baby boomers who grew up dancing independently, that they might want to invest a little in learning the foxtrot so that they could hold another person in their older age and find the joy of two bodies coming together, not for sexuality, but for creating a euphoria out of the dance by having this embrace, and at the same time having the music and all the beautiful heritage that we have as a culture. How's that?
Good. Well, Sue, thank you so much for your time and for answering all of these questions. And, you know, maybe some of the things that I brought up to you, maybe it'll click, maybe you'll have some ideas, and, you know, we'll get back together again and see what you come up with. But, you know, there certainly are a lot of interesting connections around Vito, and, you know, it's possible that he was either used as a willful idiot, or which the evidence doesn't really seem to point to, or maybe he just never told you about some of his goings on.
Yeah, he told me about everything.
He did.
I mean, he was discreet about his affairs.
Right.
But as far as his life and his experiences, he delighted in making those into stories, and he told the whole gang. Every night he went on and on, and he couldn't stop talking. And but he talked beautifully, and he told beautiful stories.
But he never mentioned anything about working with the government or any agencies or anything, huh?
You know, he was a merchant marine during World War II, and that's the only involvement he had with the government.
That you're aware of?
Yeah.
Yeah. All right, Sue. Well, thank you so very much for your time, and I really appreciate it.
Sure, Jan.
All right. Thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Bye-bye.
Bye.